Okay, so today is finishing out chapter 6, and then next week I'm going to cover chapter 7. I already posted the notes online, and then we're going to get to chapter 8 on Thursday. And so for Monday, we're going to be covering section 7.1 through 7.5, which is talking about perturbations all the way up to gravitational waves. And actually, it's mostly 7.1 through 7.4, and then for the production of gravitational waves, I just do very, very briefly. So there's a couple things in there that are important. And then I think for Thursday, we're basically going to cover 8.1 through 8.5. And that would be everything except for gravitational lensing and some stuff about our universe specifically and about inflation. Yeah.
Well, I did notice, I started reading 7, and it's 7 and 8 are 100 pages.
Yeah.
So you're saying we could just focus on reading these sections,
right,
and not try to over...
Right.
Because it's hard to follow the equations and read it. I mean, it's usually my whole Saturday... And some.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, for me to make up one of these lectures worth of notes takes about 6 to 8 hours. So, you know, and that's having read it, you know, before and gone through the material before. So it does take quite a while to get through this stuff. And that's why I'm saying it's not, we don't have time to cover the entire chapter and do the whole thing justice. So I'm thinking, you know, focus on the things that I think are the most important. Because it's seven, in chapter 7, the stuff that we're going to cover is really the meat of the gravitational wave stuff and the perturbative space-time. And once you know that, you can do anything with it. 7.5, most of that 7.5 is going through a derivation on how do you actually solve for the sources of gravitational waves, or how to solve gravitational waves from their sources for like a simple case, and just laying out the mathematics to it. And I'm not going to go through that in a lot of detail. I'm just going to kind of show you how to set it up and then skip to some results. In 7.6, it's, you know, energy loss stuff, which is important, good stuff to know, but really... And actually, it's relevant because in 1993, the Nobel Prize was given for finding a binary pulsar system, which the energy loss of it corresponded to gravitational waves, and it was the first indirect proof of a gravitational wave. And that was actually discovered in, like, 74, and they got the prize in 93. And so this section basically goes through how they did it, and how they would actually do that calculation. And then 7.7, there's a lot of stuff on gravitational wave detection and how gravitational wave interferometers and things work. And it's really short for being able to capture what they really do, but it's some of the material also is kind of a little bit dated because, you know, there have been a lot of advances since the time they wrote the book, even with what's going on with these interferometers. And plus, you know, they talk a lot about LISA, and LISA is no longer a NASA project. And that's kind of in limbo about what it's even going to be. And then in Chapter 8, the stuff I don't cover, or the stuff I'm not planning to cover, I still have to work on the notes, is there's stuff on gravitational lensing. And there's a lot of stuff that I am going to cover in Chapter 7, which lays out some of the basics of going towards gravitational lensing. And all Chapter 8 does is just take it and put it into a cosmological sense and assigns more numbers to it. And then the stuff about our universe is basically going back and explaining, you know, how do you compare the theory with the experiment on some of the cosmology, and they're actually putting in numbers about energy densities of the vacuum and expansion of the space-time and stuff like that. And so it's one of these things you can just, once you know it, you can read more on it. And inflation is kind of similar to that. So I'm trying to work the best we can with the limited time we've got, which means that we don't, you know, we could make a whole other course, actually several other courses on just the applications of the general relativity that we've done here. Like when I was in grad school, I had an entire course on gravitational waves and gravitational wave detection. So it's basically chapter 7 of this book expanded out into an entire semester with a lot of reading material and a lot of stuff behind it. And, you know, stuff in chapter 6, chapter 7, chapter 8, chapter 9, each of those is like its own course, if done right. Okay. So, what I want to get to today is finishing off chapter 6. And this is where the really cool stuff comes in. And, like I said before, when we talk about black holes, the Schwarzschild solution is just the beginning. And it's a very idealized case of a black hole where it has no spin, it has no charge, it just sits there, it's not, you know, nothing is accreting onto it. And so it gets kind of boring. But what we can do is we can add charge and spin and make things a little bit more interesting. And so the Reisner-Nordström is a charged black hole solution, where you can have electric or magnetic charge. And so what they do is they start off with the same symmetry as you'd have for a Schwarzschild black hole. So you're assuming this thing is not spinning or anything like that. And you can see that you put these exponentials in with alpha and beta the same way we did for the Schwarzschild black hole. But the only difference is that the right-hand side of the Einstein equation is no longer going to be zero. It's actually going to be the electromagnetic field equations, since it's not really a vacuum if it's got those field equations. And so this is the stress energy tensor, which is made up of the electromagnetic field tensors. And what they've done here is they have these general solutions for the electromagnetic field tensors, F of R and T and G of R and T, where the F of R and T represents the radioelectric field, and the G of theta and phi represent a radio magnetic field. And the reason, of course, the radial is because they have to come from the black hole. You know, it has to be their source. And so, therefore, it's got to be radial. But you notice here that the magnetic field depends on the angular coordinates, where the electric field depends on the radial coordinates. And you can kind of think about it as when you look at the electromagnetic field tensor and you got this matrix, the electric field is going to be in the RT or in the you know, on the outside components of it. So it's mostly going to be in the time part and R. And then the magnetic field components are on the interior of that matrix. And so that's going to be the theta and phi. So what happens now is that you can compress Maxwell and Einstein's equations down into these little two equations. Where the first one is Maxwell's equations, which is the sign of you know, divergence of the electromagnetic field tensor equals zero. And that's just, you know, works for the Maxwell's equations. For the Einstein, and then also this is assuming that there's no current out there flowing around. For the Einstein's equations, basically you replace the stress tensor with the electromagnetic field equations, and you can get you know, this Bianchi identity that works with the Ricci tensor, but now it's working with this electromagnetic field tensor. So this effectively is Einstein's equation.
Both of them or the bottom one?
The bottom one. No, this is Maxwell's, this is Einstein.
Okay.
And so you could see that the stress energy, the electromagnetic field tensor enters into Einstein's equation through the stress tensor. And the metric enters into Maxwell's equations. So you've got a mix going on in there. Maxwell and Einstein together. So you solve this and you get the Reisner-Nordström metric. And you can see here that it looks like the Schwarzschild metric, except you have these dels in there, where the del is equal to 1 minus 2gm over r plus g times q squared plus p squared over r squared. And this last term here is just coming from the fact that it's charged. And you can see that if you get rid of the electric and magnetic charge, you revert back to the Schwarzschild solution, which is what you'd expect. So here, m is the mass of the gravitational source, or the black hole. Q is electric charge, and P is magnetic charge. And let's forget for a minute that there's no such thing as magnetic charge or monopoles. And so what happens is the electric field is just the RT component of the electromagnetic field tensor, which is equal to Q over R squared. The magnetic field is the electromagnetic field tensor divided by R squared sine theta, which is just P over R squared.
What part shows, let's see, you said if you have no charge or no, was it momentum?
No, that's electric charge and magnetic field charge. So if these two terms go to zero, this whole last term disappears. And you're left with the Schwarzschild.
Here's the magnetic charge.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Oh, you just end up with that little 1 minus 2g over m over r.
Yeah. So it just falls out and you got Schwarzschild.
All right.
Now, we know from looking at the Schwarzschild solution that if GRR goes to zero, that's going to represent an event horizon. And so GRR is equal to this del of R. You can see from right up here. And that is equal to 1 minus the 2gm over r and the g q squared p squared over r squared. And if you set that equal to 0, the solution for that is now a quadratic equation. Before it was just a linear equation because it was only two terms. And so what happens is you don't get one answer. You get two. So you got r plus and r minus, where you solve the quadratic equation, using quadratic formula, and you got the GM plus or minus and then the square root of these other two terms. And you can see here that if you set Q squared and P squared equal to zero, then this just becomes either zero or 2GM. But if this is non-zero, then what happens is if it's if this term is smaller than 2G than the GM squared term, then you end up with two solutions. If it's larger than this over here, then you get an imaginary number here, which means no solution. And so you can either have 0, 1, or 2 event horizons, depending on your situation. And so depending on how much charge you've got is going to determine how many horizons you get. And so let's look at the case with 0 horizons. And that is where GM squared is going to dominate, the charges are going to dominate the GM squared term. And so what happens is, that means you have 0 horizons because R never, the inverse metric of GRR never goes to 0. And so what happens then is that del is always going to be positive, because you can see here, if this term is greater than this term, del is always going to be positive number. And if del is always positive, then of course it never goes to zero. T is always going to be time-like. R is always going to be space-like, so they never flip over. R equals zero is still going to be a singularity, because you could see that R equals zero, both of these two are going to blow up still. This one's actually going to blow up more because it's R squared. So you're going to go to positive infinity. But infinity is infinity. And an observer then would be able to travel to and from the singularity without ever passing through an event horizon. And that means you're going to get a naked singularity. So that's one way to actually construct a naked singularity. Now, the geodesics, when you solve the geodesic equation, that's going to imply that you're going to have a repulsive singularity, time-like geodesics that never intersect at r equals zero. They just simply approach you to move away. And so this is a conformal diagram where you, from out here at infinity, here's the singularity. And so you see that, you know, all the geodesics are actually going to end up going like this, kind of going around the singularity.
Infinity is over there to the right? Where's infinity?
Yeah, well, remember, this is a conformal diagram like we had before. So this, I think, is spatial infinity. This is the time-like future infinity, and this is the time-like past infinity. And so you can see that you always end up going around singularity. You never actually go into the singularity in the time-like future. Now, the thing that they say about this is that this is really an impossible solution. And the reason why is because if the charge dominates the gravitational field, which is basically what q squared plus p squared greater than gm squared means. Actually, that should be, gm squared. See, it should be g squared m squared. Yeah, just notice the mistake there. Oh, no, it is gm squared because you divide through by... You divide through by g here, so that is right. So it's gm squared. So what happens is, if that's the case, then your electromagnetic force is enough to keep this thing from collapsing gravitationally. So you can never actually. It's like it's possible to have this thing, but you can never build it. And so you can't, you know, it's kind of impossible to explain how can you get all this charge into this black hole and yet have the black hole collapse into a black hole to the point where it can get all this charge in. The charge would just simply repel and it would never actually fall in. And so that means this is really unphysical. It would never actually happen. So it's kind of unlikely. The next scenario is that the gravitation is greater than the charge, which is gm squared is greater than q squared plus p squared. And so that means you end up with two horizons because you have two solutions for r. In this case, the electromagnetic field energy is less than the gravitational energy, so you can still get this collapse. And so you've got two coordinate singularities now instead of one, which you can see here, because r goes to zero at each of these points. When that happens, both r plus and r minus are going to be null surfaces and event horizons. You really can't say anything as one is any better than the other one. You're still going to get a singularity at r equals zero, because that's where the, you know, everything's going to go infinite, and or time is still going to blow up. And you can also see that r plus is going to behave just like 2gm in the Schwarzschild metric, where as you fall in through r plus, space and time are going to switch. Your light cone's going to tilt. And you're going to be sucked in with no hope of return. But then you hit R minus and everything flips back. And, you know, everything seems fine. You can do whatever you want. And so you can, once you flip back, then all of a sudden you can stop going towards a singularity if you don't want to. And, you know, your life takes on new options. And you can actually move back and... you know, actually out past R plus if you want, but through a different black hole. And so this is actually the way this would actually look in a conformal diagram, where again,
this is spatial infinity. These are time-like infinity, and you know, and where you see this squiggly line is the singularities. And so what happens here is you actually start off in this phase here, and you travel in through R plus, and then hit R minus, and you can kind of stop, and you can go wherever you want. You can go towards the singularity, but you don't want to go there. So you just keep going, and you can go through R plus in a different black hole, and then another R minus, and then you end up in another space.
And that is the path, the squiggly, the tighter squiggle is singularity.
Yeah, that's the squiggly, the tight squiggly lines are singularities. Yes. This is actually the path.
Right. This is a graph of several black holes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So these are a network of black holes. Yeah, this is what they call in science fiction the Einstein-Rosen bridge or the wormhole. Yeah.
I will tell you, gentlemen, this is amazing. I study something called Jinshin Jutsu, and they say as above, so below, meaning in the abstract is also the concrete.
Mm-hmm.
And in our bodies is an energy field, and there's the main central, then the supervisors, but the diagonal crosses three places. I mean, your diagram just happens to be three. Crosses three places to build out the body. And it's like...
Well, similar to what they do.
It's very similar. In other words, as above, so below. As in the abstract, so in the concrete. That's amazing.
Well, like I said, this is a really interesting, inspiring thing because this is, like I said, if you've got a black hole... It's more likely than not going to be charged or going to be spinning. So you would actually have something more like this than the point of no return.
When you go from the on the path from one black hole to the next, you're in a wormhole.
Well, actually, what's happening here
is you're
here is a space. So you're actually going from this universe here, and you're going inside R plus, which means you go into kind of this. Space where you would normally go towards a black hole, but then you can actually go out of it again because you can say, well, I don't want to hit a singularity, so I'm going to go out. But when you go out, you actually could end up in a different space. You have to go through another horizon in that one. So it's kind of, from this diagram, it's hard to tell, but maybe it's possible you can actually turn around and go out this way. Or maybe you end up out here where there's some other black hole over here. You've never really interacted with more than one black hole, but it's kind of looks like you could have. And you could actually have a network of black holes here. And you can actually see you go around like this, and you can go into a different one, and end up out here, and over here, and just keep going.
And so, yeah, you can actually do that and sort of, you know, choose where you're going to end up. The thing is, you're still going to have to put up with all the tidal forces and everything on your way in. So,
you said different universe. Did you mean different?
Well, it could be different. It could be a different place within our universe.
Our universe.
Or it could be.
There's only one universe, right?
Yeah. Well, depends on who you ask.
Okay.
But, yeah, it could be a different universe. It could be a different place in our universe. There's really no way to tell because once you go through the horizon... It's a horizon, so you can't really see what's on the other side. So you could end up, you know, saying, well, this is a black hole and then this is a white hole. So what happens here is you have an observer. They're about to pass R1 or R-, and then they see an entire infinite history of the outside universe in a finite amount of proper time, and it's going to be infinitely blue-shifted because... What's happening is, when you pass through, you still have all that time dilation, and the red shift and everything. But then you go through the other one, and it's blue shifted. So it might take you infinitely long to cross through this event horizon. And then when you go through this one, the exact opposite can happen. So there's a lot of weird stuff that can happen here. And any non-spherical symmetric perturbation that comes into this Reisner Nordstrom hole will disrupt the geometry of the space-time and possibly destroy the network of the wormholes. or neutralize the black hole. And if the black hole gets neutralized, then it collapses the two event horizons together, and you end up having to go right in towards a singularity, and you're doomed. So it's kind of one of these delicate balancing things, but at least there's something interesting going on here. And then there's the case of the single singularity, which is where the charge exactly balances the gravitational pull. And this is called an extreme Reisner-Nordström solution. And when we see extreme here, what that means is that you're right at the edge of doing a collapse. And so you have to actually bleed off some charge in order for it to collapse. And so here, you do have one singularity, and it happens at GM instead of at 2GM. And R equals GM is going to become a null, but it's time-like on both sides. So in other words, it's like those two event horizons kind of collapse together at some point. And when they collapse together, it's like you're falling in, and then all of a sudden you switch. I mean, you switch back instantly. So your R equals 2GM, or GM, you're going to have this time-like progression on both sides. And at R equals 0, you're still going to have this time-like singularity. And then here's the conformal diagram where you can imagine this is out at spatial infinity, and you're coming in, and you cross the horizon, and it's like it switches and switches back, and then you can go into the singularity, or you can go out here. But it is similar to the two-horizon case, but the singularity is always on one side, where before you got singularities on both sides. Now, since the charge and the mass balance, if you have two identical extreme Reisner-Nordström holes, they're going to attract gravitationally, but they're going to repel electromagnetically. And so that'd be really interesting to see what happens.
Did you not have a positively charged and a negatively charged?
Yeah, in which cases, positively charged and negatively charged are going to really attract, because they're going to attract gravitationally and electromagnetically, but then when they collide, they're going to neutralize, and you're going to end up with a big Schwarzschild black hole and probably a huge release of gravitational waves. And so you could see here that if you have this Reisner-Nordström metric and you take GM squared equals to Q squared, then what happens is you can write this like so, where you have, it looks just like the Schwarzschild, only this is GM instead of 2GM. And you notice this is 2 here instead of 1. And so you get something that looks a lot like the Schwarzschild, because, again, you just have this one singularity. But then you notice here that if you take rho and you put it equal to R minus GM, so it's kind of like your distance from the singularity, and you define H to be 1 plus GM over rho, then you can rewrite your metric in terms of H. This is starting to look a lot like a homework problem. And if you could take this again, and we're just going to change rho equal to the magnitude of X, or from position. And then here is just written in Cartesian coordinates. And if the electric field is equal to the electromagnetic field tensor of RT component, which is just Q over R squared, and that's the same thing as just saying the R derivative of the scalar potential, and the scalar potential is just equal to minus Q over R, then we can use this to say that A naught, the scalar potential, is equal to minus the square root of GM over rho plus GM. And that tells us that the square root of G times A,
not is just equal to the inverse of h minus 1.
And so if you plug the metric and electrostatic potential into the Einstein and Maxwell's equations, and you assume that h is time independent, you get that the Laplacian of h is equal to 0. And you know how to solve Laplace's equation. So at infinity, if h is equal to 1 plus this little perturbation, which looks like the Newtonian gravity, then this can describe a system of n extremal Reisner-Nordström black holes with a mass ma, and the charge is going to go like square root of g ma. So it's kind of neat because it's like if you're just in this one little extreme case, then you can actually explain everything that's going on in terms of this charge. And the whole reason why they did h here, and you know, it took a little bit of coordinate changes to get to it, is just because we know how to solve this Laplace's equation pretty well. And we know, like from electrodynamics, that when you see Laplace's equation, that the solution is that you have this, you know, point charge, which has an infinite potential, and then as you go out, it just dies away. Potential just dies away. And to give you something like that. Any questions so far? All right. I want to move on. The next thing I want to talk about is the Kerr black hole. And the idea here is that now we've got a black hole just kind of going back to Schwarzschild, but it's going to be spinning. So where with Schwarzschild you had the spherical symmetry, now you have axial symmetry because it spins around its central axis. But it's also stationary, and so it has a time-like killing vector as well. So this solution came about in 1963. I can't remember when the Reisner-Nordström solution came about. But you could see that the solution, it looks a lot like the Schwarzschild solution. The only difference is, first off, you've got cross terms here. So you notice you have dt d phi terms here. And anytime you see cross terms in a metric, that means that you actually have motion in that particular direction. So this is where the spin is coming in. And you've also got, instead of just 2gm over r, you've got 2gmr over rho squared, where rho squared comes from r squared plus a squared cosine theta, and a is the ratio of angular momentum to mass. So with a black hole, when we say angular momentum, a lot of time we mean is angular momentum per unit mass. And so there's a difference here between a is equal to 1 and a is equal to a million and a is equal to 0.1. Well, obviously, if you have too much angular momentum, you know, it's gonna change things. And then also, and outside of that, you can see that all the rest of the metric terms, they're not that different. I mean, you've got your r squared term, which is rho squared over delta. And if you take a equal to 0, rho and r are the same, and this kind of collapses down to being the Schwarzschild. This term completely disappears because you got a in the numerator. This term, again, would collapse down to just being Schwarzschild, and the rest of the stuff just changes back. So this is a way of just kind of writing a solution, and obviously we're not going through all the work of solving it. But if you take the 2GMR term and replace it with 2GMR minus GQ squared plus P squared, then you get a Kerr-Newman black hole, which is a charge-spinning black hole. And you can see here,
that the vector potentials would be written in terms of Q and P. And then also in the P term, or actually in both of them, you've got A also in here. So the angular momentum term comes into play with the scalar potential through the magnetic field, and it comes into play on both of these, mostly through the electric charge for the magnetic vector potential. And so you can basically play around with this, and you can see how you go from this Kerr-Newman, and you can split out, take A to zero, which is taking the angular momentum to zero, or you can take the charges to zero and get back to Schwarzschild or get back to the other ones. But basically, if you know this one, this is the most general solution to a spherical black hole you're going to find. I mean, there's other solutions, of course, because you could actually add perturbations onto your black hole. You can have a black hole that actually looks more like a football, and that's spinning and charged, and what's going to happen to that? I mean, over time, it'll ring down into a spherical black hole, but in the meantime, you get some interesting dynamics. So one way we study this is we use the Boyer-Lindquist coordinates, and this is just basically TR, theta, and phi, where we say A is fixed, and the mass is going to go to zero. And if you do that, then what happens is you could see that your metric now just looks like you're just studying the space-time by itself. And you see you have the minus t squared, and you have all this stuff on the r term, which depends on angular momentum. And you can see this angular momentum disappears. It just kind of goes back down to a just a regular Minkowski space-time. And then you can see the same thing with the theta and phi terms. So the idea is that this is a space-time that's spinning. And if you reduce that, it just kind of goes back to being a regular Minkowski space-time. And so now we do transformations to Cartesian, where you might take the angular momentum term and the radial term, and you combine them together, and you end up getting something like x, y, and z. Now we've got two killing vectors that are going to come out naturally. One is going to be the time-like killing vector, which is just pointing forward in time. And the other one is going to be the radial killing vector, which comes from the spin. And if you notice here that K, the time-like killing vector, is not orthogonal to any hypersurface, so the metric is going to be stationary, but it's not going to necessarily be static. And say, so that basically means that your time-like killing, if your time-like killing vector were orthogonal to the hypersurface, then you'd have a killing horizon, and that would be a sign that you've got something that's static. So this is a little bit different. And you can see here that your killing tensor that you have, this is just a tensor that obeys the Killing's equation, and this is the killing equation for that tensor. So you've got sigma with all these indices, mu1 all the way to mun, and then you've got this symmetrized with the lambda, with a derivative in the lambda direction, and you're going to get zero. Now this sigma is going to be equal to 2 rho squared L symmetrized with N plus R squared G mu nu. And so this is the Kerr killing tensor. And L in this case, and these are Boyer-Lindquist coordinates again, it goes like 1 over del, and then the r, or the time part is r squared plus a squared. The del is the r, and you've got 0 and a. And then n is the same, similar to that, only you've got a minus del, and this is 1 over 2 rho squared instead of 1 over del. And so what happens is l and n are two null vectors. So when you contract them with themselves, you get 0. But when you contract one with the other one, you get minus 1.
And so if you want an event horizon to show up, then GRR needs to go to zero, and GRR is just going to be del over rho squared, and you can see that from right here. And so we're kind of using GRR goes to zero for the definition of an event horizon. And so therefore, del is going to needs to go to zero. Rho doesn't really matter here. And so that's going to be equal to this. And again, you have a quadratic equation. And so you solve the quadratic equation, and you've got gm plus or minus g squared m squared minus a squared. And just like with Reisner and Nordstrom, if A dominates, in other words, you have more angular momentum than you have gravitational force, then you end up with a naked singularity because you have no event horizons. But like Reisner and Nordstrom, if you've got that much angular momentum, then you can't collapse into a black hole. So if you got a star, it's spinning fast enough, and as it comes in and collapses, it keeps spinning faster and faster, you have conservation of angular momentum, then what will happen is the only way it can ever collapse into a black hole is if it bleeds off its angular momentum through gravitational waves. And then it'll collapse into a black hole. If GM is equal to A, that's called an extremal Kerr solution, which is unstable because it's going to either have to bleed off more and collapse, or it'll pick up more angular momentum and not collapse. And then if GM is greater than A, then you get two horizons. And so both R plus and R minus are going to be event horizons, but not killing horizons. Because if in order for them to be killing horizons, then they have to have that killing vector that's orthogonal to them. And so you've got this picture here of what is actually happening in this Kerr black hole. And this is really, really interesting because you've got this stationary limit surface, which we talked about last time, which is a surface where it's kind of like you can see, how did they define it before? I want to use their words on this. The stationary limit surface is basically the surface of the ergosphere, and it's a place where if you contract the killing vector with itself, then that's what you get. And so it's sort of like the very edge of this ergosphere, where the ergosphere is the part where if this space-time is spinning, it's going to actually drag the space-time around it with it. And so inside this surface, the killing vector is space-like, and right on the surface it's null, and outside it would be time-like. And so you could see here, you get the ergosphere, and then you've got the first, and then you see this actually depends on theta, and then you got the first event horizon, R plus, then you got the second event horizon, R minus. But the really cool thing is, look at what happens to the singularity. Instead of just having a singularity at R equals zero, you end up with the singularity at R at rho equals zero. And so, and I'll get to this a little bit more, but your singularity basically becomes a donut. And so you can see here that when you contract the killing vector with itself, it's going to give you this, and you can see that that's not going to be equal to zero. Because you can throw in the numbers here and see you've got R squared 2GMR plus A squared. And so at the horizons, Dell's going to go to zero. And if Dell goes to zero, then this is not going to be equal to zero. The total thing is not going to be zero. So you're not going to have this go to zero at the horizons like you normally would, which is how we defined a stationary limit surface before. Unless you're at the poles, in which case you can see that they correspond then. So before, you could say that, you know, the stationary limit surface was actually the surface of the it was actually the surface of the limit of the ergosphere, and now it's something different. And so the Killing vector is space-like at R plus, except at the poles where it's going to go null. And at the stationary limit surface, it's going to go to zero, which is actually going to be further out. If you'd see that, and that's going to depend a lot on the angle momentum. And you could see here, what we did was we just took this and we solved for where this thing is going to go to zero. And so the ergosphere is going to be inside of the stationary limit surface. And you have to move with the black hole's rotation, but you can move towards or away from the event horizon any way you want. I just want to check something real quick. I don't see this in the book, but I think this is also what they call the apparent horizon. Now, also you notice that your singularity has to occur at rho equals zero, because if you look here, at rho equals zero, here it is. At rho equals zero, that's where this term is going to blow up, not at r equals zero. So at rho equals zero,
as it approaches zero?
No, rho is equal to zero. So at rho equals zero, you get a singularity. Because if you look at the time-like part of the metric,
yeah,
this blows up at rho equals zero.
And I just want to, for one moment, understand what the word blows up means. It means that that's very small, so that term becomes very large.
Infinite.
So you've got 1 minus infinity. So you've got minus infinity dt.
Right.
Dt.
And that's where we say that that's a singularity.
Oh, so the metric is the line goes like that.
Yeah. And at that point, what happens is all the time-like vectors are going to cross it. That's why it's a singularity. And so what happens then is, if that happens at rho equals zero instead of r equals zero, then you can see that as r equals zero, then you would still have a squared cosine squared theta equals rho squared. So you would actually have to have theta equal pi over 2 as well, not just r equals 0. And so you end up with a ring that occurs here. And so this ring exists like this. And so the neat thing is now you've got a ring instead of a point representing your singularity.
So that little straight line in there at r equals 0 is actually a ring, and you showed it in two...
Yeah.
You showed it, like, on this dimension,
mm-hmm.
And it looks like a line.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's really weird, but yeah. So in other words, if you're coming down from theta equals 0, you can go right through and not see a singularity, and just pass right through the ring. And so what happens here is
you're passing through the black hole.
Mm-hmm. And so you've got your conformal diagram here where you can start off in a space-time over here and you go through the different horizons, and then
you don't go through the ring and you just keep flowing.
Well, and that diagram has no singularities.
Well, actually, it's just these R equals zero singularities, so we can't write them as a squiggly line because it doesn't only exist at that one point since it's a ring. So that's why we drew them as straight lines. And because if you look at it, if you come in from a different angle with theta, then that changes everything. Because if theta equals zero, for example, it wouldn't see it would see the two horizons, but it would not see a singularity. It would just be like you just go right through. If you come in from this direction, then you pass through an ergosphere, then you pass through the two horizons, and then you see the singularity. So it's kind of weird, but it actually depends a lot on your approach.
That the straight line singularity that goes from, I guess you could say, negative time light to positive time light, mm-hmm. is that the sort of straight line ring in here?
Yeah, that's a singularity.
And those two lines are equivalent.
Yeah.
Just shown in two different pictorial forms.
Well, this is a conformal diagram. That one's actually a picture. So it's a little bit different. So, yeah, you can't really draw the singularity the same way since it doesn't appear. But near the ring, you can actually get close time-like curves and everything else you would see around a singularity. So the lesson is, if you ever find yourself in a spaceship getting sucked towards a spinning black hole, head for the poles. Don't stay in the equator. Might have a shot then. Now, if theta plus T is theta and T are constant, and R is small and negative, then you can actually have a negative value in this ds squared. For imaginary value. And I think that's just something you want to put in there, although it's kind of hard to imagine having negative values of R. But I guess that's like when you go a little bit further. You also have this thing called frame dragging, and this is kind of like what Gravity Probe B was looking for. We have a photon, it's emitted in the phi direction of a curved black hole. And so it has a metric that looks sort of like this. And, you know, they kind of left off the theta. They just kind of just, and the R, just looked at it in terms of, because they kept R to be constant and they kept theta to be constant and just looked at dragging it along in the phi direction. And so your d phi dt, you can get out of this. As by just looking at the ratio of these two metric terms. And you notice that if you have a photon and it moves against the hole, so the photon's trying to go the other way from the way the hole is spinning, then d phi dt goes to zero. But if you actually move with the black hole, then you can actually have d phi dt different. In this case, it actually would have a non-zero value that depends on the angular momentum of the black hole.
When you say against and with, you mean against the angular momentum direction?
Right. Right. So in other words, if it's spinning clockwise and the hole and the light comes in from the other direction against the way it's spinning, then it'll actually end up having a d phi dt equals zero. And so what this also tells us is that if you have a massive particle, then a massive particle is going to get dragged along with the hole's rotation inside the stationary limit, so inside the ergosphere. And so you can see here, omega sub h is d phi dt at the at the outer horizon.
Is that a little negative sign? What's that little noise?
That means the minimum angular velocity of a particle in the horizon. So that minus means a minimum. Yeah, but you're right. There's a little minus sign here. And you know, and this is going to end up being a over r plus squared plus a squared. All right. All right, so the last thing we're going to go over in this chapter, yeah, we've managed to make it through this entire chapter in two lectures, is black hole thermodynamics. And this is one of those things that has been studied quite a bit because they've been able to, you know, this is what Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose and a lot of these other guys have worked on, where they found a lot of parallels between black holes and curved space-time and thermodynamic systems. And this sort of relates to that paper I handed you guys earlier in the semester where they were actually comparing GR to condensed matter systems. And so for black hole thermodynamics, you start off looking at the motion along geodesics in a Kerr metric. And so you've got these two killing vectors. One is the time-like killing vector. The other is a rotational killing vector. And the four momenta of a particle is given by basically mass times core velocity. And so you can define the energy and the angular momentum using these killing vectors. And so you take the time-like killing vector, contract it with the four momenta, and you got energy. And so that should come out to be this big function dealing with the metric terms. And you see you have dt d tau here, and this is d phi d tau for the other one. And for the angular momentum, you would just take the rotational killing vector and contract it with the four momentum, and then you've got this other stuff. And again, this just depends here a lot on the angle theta, which is what you'd expect. So inside the ergosphere, this time killing vector is space-like, and what that means is that when you contract it, that this is space-like and momentum is space-like, you contract the two together, and you're going to end up, space-like and time-like, you contract the two together, and you're going to get something that's going to be, with this minus one, is going to be negative.
So this killing vector is time-like, and the momentum is space-like?
No, the killing vector would be space-like.
And the four momentum is...
Yeah. Yeah, because it's... the coordinate here is space-like, and so when you take a time derivative of it, it should be orthogonal to that, so it should be time-like. Another way of looking at that is four velocity is time-like. And when you contract a time-like, if you contract two time-like vectors together, then you get a negative value. If you contract two space-like vectors together, or a space-like and a time-like, then you get a positive value. And so this should be negative, which means that you actually have negative energy. And so what that means is that a particle that's inside the ergosphere is either going to remain there or it's going to be accelerated until it has positive energy. And so it just keeps losing more and more energy, that negative energy, and it can't escape with negative energy. So this gives us an opportunity to talk about the Penrose process. And the idea here is that this is a way of extracting energy. So this is alternative energy. The idea is that if you have a rotating black hole, and let's say it's 100 billion years from now and every star in the sky is burnt out and, you know, you need energy to keep running your television, then this is a way of producing energy. So what you do is you throw a mass into the horizon. And when you throw that mass into the horizon, an object can escape from the ergosphere because it has more energy than it did originally because there's negative energy in the object you're throwing in. That means you get more energy because it's conservation of energy. And so effectively, when you do that, you're reducing the angular momentum of the black hole. And so you keep throwing more junk in, it gets negative. It takes away angular momentum, which you get on the way out, and you get kicked out the other way. And I think there was some science fiction where they actually had that as a you know, civilization long far in the future, and they were basically had a black hole, and they were using the black hole to extract all the energy that they needed to live off of.
That what happened to our monkey?
Something like that, yeah.
No, I thought he was going to fall into the black hole.
Yeah, that's also how space monkeys can try to escape.
Oh, if the monkey had an inventory of coconuts, he could throw coconuts into the black hole and
keep
himself out.
Yep, extract enough energy and just get out. So, you've got this combination of these... killing vectors, angular killing vector and rotational killing vector and a timeline killing vector. And you sum them up and you get a new killing vector, where this one is null at the event horizon. And so this chi killing vector, you contract that with the four momentum. And this is basically the four momentum in two dimensions at the hypersurface. So this is like, imagine a hypersurface, just the surface of the black hole, or the surface of the horizon, then it's going to actually be negative, because that's going to be the total momentum of the object, very much like this was the angular momentum, then this is total momentum, and so that's going to be negative, and the angular momentum is also going to be negative. And so, therefore, the delta of the mass is going to be like the energy, two dimensions. The delta of J, the current, is going to be like the angular momentum, which is going to be less than the mass divided by this H, omega H. Where again, omega H comes from this term. So what happens here is we end up, we can build this into getting something that looks like thermodynamics eventually. So the area of an event horizon can't decrease. That was one of the rules that Hawking and these other guys had. Although the mass can decrease and the angular momentum decreases in combination. So you can decrease the mass, but you can't decrease the area.
It becomes less dense.
Well, what happens is, as the mass decreases, it's got to be some combination of mass and angular momentum in order to keep it the same area. And the idea is that the reason why you can't decrease the area is, if you can imagine, you've got this space with this horizon that's empty. If you decrease the area, like say all of a sudden you make the black hole smaller, then that meant stuff just left outside of the horizon, which isn't allowed. So you kind of run into a big pickle there.
Well,
and so, yeah.
Will all black holes end up being the same size?
No. All different sizes. So what happens is the mass and the angular momentum kind of combine to keep the area constant. So, you know, if you can look at it like the radius, can give you an idea of the area, and so you can kind of mess around with these two numbers in order to keep that constant. So if you drain off angular momentum, then something has to happen with the mass in order to compensate. And if you take, for example, you throw something in order to pull out some angular momentum, then that's going to bring in more, add more mass, and that's going to keep everything balanced. So now, here is the three metric, and we contract that. Use that to contract dxi, dxj terms, and you get all this stuff. And this is the d phi squared term. This is the d theta squared term. And so you can calculate the area by just simply integrating the determinant of the three metric over the angular coordinates. So just integrate over theta and phi with a fixed radius, essentially. And so that's this, is the determinant of the metric. And so we're integrating over the outside horizon. So because that's the one that, you know, is going to most represent the area of the black hole. And so the area is going to be 4 pi times r plus squared plus a squared. And you can see here that what happens is if you take r plus and you square it at this outer horizon, then you're going to get a term in here which is going to cancel this angular momentum with this angular momentum. But then you're going to also get a cross term in there, this term and this term. So the angular momentum is going to stay a part of it, but it's still going to give you something where its area is going to depend on angular momentum and on mass. So we have this thing called an irreducible mass, which is a mass calculated from the area of the black hole. So in other words, if you take the mass of the black hole, or sorry, you take the area of this black hole by looking at the size of the horizon, and you know that that can never decrease, then even if you get rid of all the angular momentum, that area is still going to be the same or bigger. And so this irreducible mass is area divided by 16 pi g squared. Or that's that irreducible mass squared. And so that becomes 1/2, and then there's the mass terms here, and then it's the angular momentum term.
So this is like a minimum sizing for a black hole.
Right. Right. Because what happens is, if you think about it, it's just basically saying that this is the mass, or this is the minimum mass that this black hole can have, in a way. And so you can if you get rid of the angular momentum, you're still going to get something this big or bigger as far as area. And if you do a delta in this irreducible mass, which is basically how this irreducible mass changes with respect to the mass and the angular momentum, what you get is something here that is always going to be positive. Because remember, the mass term is going to be greater than the angular momentum term and all this other stuff. And so what this means is that the mass of this black hole is always going to be, it can't get smaller, it's got to get bigger. And so M minus the irreducible mass is the maximum amount of energy that you can extract from a black hole.
Is that little equation there, M minus IR, is that equal to delta N?
No. No, this delta M represents how the irreducible mass changes when you change the mass or you change the angular momentum. This represents how much energy you can extract off from a black hole.
And you can't rewrite that as delta M.
No. They're totally different things. So yeah, this is dealing with what happens to irreducible mass as you extract off angular momentum, for example. And this basically says that no matter what you do, you're always going to increase it. And this is saying that if you are really hungry for energy and you're really willing to try to take energy away from a black hole, that how much energy can you get out of it before the black hole stops spinning and you're forced to have to find another black hole to mine. And so this is how much energy you can get out of the thing.
Do you have a word for that?
I don't know. I'm not sure what you would call that. Yeah. Well, anyway, you can take this delta in the irreducible mass, and you can turn it into a delta in the area. And what you get is this equation, which says that basically the area of the black hole is always going to increase. It could stay the same, or it can increase, but it can never decrease. And so the delta,
like the second law of thermodynamics.
Right.
But if it was a certain size and you could take away mass, why can't you shrink it down to some minimum? And then beyond that, it can't.
Yeah, and that's what that is. This is the minimum.
Okay.
Yeah, so the irreducible mass is the minimum. That's where you can't.
So we have the irreducible area, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And that's like saying that, like, well, this area, when you change these parameters, delta M and delta J, realistically, you're only going to increase the area. You can't decrease the area.
Equation for AIRR.
Irreducible area?
Yeah.
You don't need that.
you probably take the equation for irreducible mass, mm-hmm. just multiply through by 16 pi g squared as the area.
Right.
Okay.
So once you've got this delta in the area, you can flip it inside out and rewrite it as a delta in the mass. So you have, how does the mass change with respect to changes in area and angular momentum? Where this kappa term is all this other junk involving the angular momentum and the mass. And so you'll notice that this equation is very similar to the thermodynamic equation for dE equals temperature, d entropy minus pressure, d value. And so what happens is area is like entropy. This angular momentum, this J term here, I keep calling it angular momentum. It's actually like a current, which is kind of like this angular momentum, but in two dimensions. And so it's like a volume, and this omega H is like pressure. The delta M is like energy, which makes sense, energy and mass. And so that means that this term here is T, or temperature. And so the kappa here is actually like surface gravity that we talked about last time.
I mean, that the pressure, I mean, that the area would be more like the volume.
Yeah, but it's actually not, because the area always increases, just like entropy always increases. And that current, yeah. Well, angular momentum always pushes outward, kind of like pressure does. And I was looking for, well, yeah, here it is. Remember here, surface gravity, they wrote it here. And the surface gravity on a Schwarzschild black hole is 1 over 4gm. And then you look at this. Here's surface gravity. And if you take angular momentum equal to zero, then this should contract down to 4gm. So that just tells you that surface gravity is like temperature.
So going back to that equation, delta E, TdS is similar to area? Delta?
Yeah.
And
but no, TdS is like surface gravity times area is like TdS.
Surface area times gravity?
No, surface gravity times area.
And the P momentum is like the omega?
Omega H, yeah.
Omega H. And then the dV is like the J current.
Mm-hmm. I think the only thing missing here is there's a minus sign difference. But I think
omega, yeah.
Omega H? That comes from here, where we were looking at what happens when massive particles are dragged along in the ergosphere, the black hole. And so that comes from d phi dt at a minimum, which is the minimum angular velocity of a particle at the horizon multiplied by, it's just the minimum angular velocity of a particle at the horizon. And you notice, so that minimum angular velocity is the same thing as pressure. And so the idea then is that once you've gotten this far, you could see that each law of thermodynamics corresponds to something in black hole mechanics. So thermal equilibrium is like having a stationary black hole. The zeroth law of thermodynamics, it says that in temperature equilibrium, temperature is constant and surface gravity is constant. So basically, surface gravity is constant on the horizon is the same thing as being in thermal equilibrium. The first law of thermodynamics is that dE equals TdS minus PdV is the same thing as this other law we just wrote, explaining how the mass depends on the area and delta J. The second law of thermodynamics is that entropy never decreases, and that's the same thing as area of the black hole never decreases. Temperature is written in terms of surface gravity, and this is the Hawking black hole radiation temperature. S is entropy, which it relates to area. It's the black hole entropy. And then if you combine the entropy with the black hole entropy, then the delta on that is always going to be greater than or equal to zero. So in other words, it's just basically saying that, you know, entropy never decreases, black hole area never decreases, but if you combine the two together, you definitely get something that can never decrease. And so it's kind of like a generalized second law of thermodynamics.
So that last equation, delta S plus A over 4G, is that sort of script S is general relativity S, or is that classical?
Oh, this is the classical S.
That's classical S.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is general relativity.
Yeah, and this is coming from black hole entropy. So that means if you look at black holes in a larger sense, then the entropy of this system with black holes and the external universe, the total entropy shouldn't decrease. And then if you're interested in this stuff, in Chapter 9, there's actually a whole lot more that they do with this, and they actually talk about Hawking radiation and some of the other stuff that they've been able to do with this black hole radiation stuff. Because really, it has to you have to take into account quantum mechanics in order to kind of pull a little bit more out of this. Since when you look at thermodynamics and you generalize it to statistical mechanics, then what happens is, along the way, you have to use quantum mechanics to really make it work and make it work in certain ways. And so the same thing happens here. The only problem is, you know, getting quantum mechanics and relativity to work together doesn't work very well. But it works well at thermal. Okay. All right. So any questions on this stuff? All right, like I said, next time what we're going to be doing is going over Chapter 7. And I told you guys I'm basically covering 7.1 through 7.5. And then the last two sections are really worth looking at, even though we're probably not going to have time to go over them and do much in here. But at least we can have a little bit of discussion on sources of gravitational waves and on gravity wave detection. And then outside of that, on Thursday is the final lecture, and we're going to be talking about cosmology. And all that stuff is on your final, which is going to be due on the 9th. So everybody should have those questions. All right, see you next time.